Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, to say that my ears were burning at that very surprising and unlooked for tribute from John is to put it mildly. But to lead straight away into what I seriously consider to be the most important subject facing our Earth planet at this present time in history. Ufology. Now, thank heaven that I've got a thick skin. Thank heaven, probably, you think that you have thick skins. It's such a pity, a great shame, I feel personally, and I'm a non-entity, but I do feel this very strongly. I've been mixed up in the maelstrom of UFO sightings, UFO sounds, for practically 4 years. I've stuck my neck out unreservedly on the evidence that I had accumulated after 2 years in 1966. And I declared firmly to anyone who was interested, and that included Dennis Healey, the Secretary of State for War, and the Cabinet, come to Warminster and see on any clear night craft artifacts that do not comply with any conventional aircraft of this earth. For heaven's sake, come and see them for yourselves, and like me, try and determine anyway whether you think they are of this earth or extraterrestrial. Now, my first book was, if you like, a very amateurish attempt to put across fact. Yet the whole problem, one of the most perplexing incongruities and irrationalities about UFOs, craft and whoever or whatever is aboard, is that they are such fleeting ghosts of the air. Very rarely do they land. But our little team of three, John was saying just now, and best of luck too, he said that we didn't want to belong to Bephora. Now, for heaven's sake, from that remark, don't take it that we're terribly proud. We are meekly, as are you, seeking truth about this still unpredictable, still largely unknown aerial mystery. The only reason we didn't become honorary members of Bephora, and we were very thrilled to be invited to do so, was because having close contact with these craft so persistently, and I'll give you some of what I consider to be the reasons for Warminster in a moment, having such close contact, seeing incredible happenings in the sky so consistently and persistently, if we stuck our neck out as a team, we've already been vilified and reviled. Fair enough, it bounces off thick elephant hides nowadays. We're impervious to criticism even. We want to know, we're a team of three, that if we decide these craft do not deceive the eye when they fly away, they don't fly too fast to deceive the eye, they dematerialize, if we decide a major finding of that nature, fantastic though it may seem, we would still expect Bephora, to which we belonged, to back us on that claim. And we would never make any claim which was extravagant. That was the sole reason. We didn't want all Bephora taking the can back publicly, and we're sniped at by all sorts of cynics and skeptics. We did not want them to take the can back for assumptions, pretty good assumptions, that we make. That's the only reason. I like Bephora very much. I like contact very much. We have helpers from both organizations coming down to Warminster, and they seriously apply themselves to diligent study of these phenomena. Now, this is a continuation, I understand, this evening, and I'm speaking off the cuff as I usually do, a continuation of the Warminster story. Is it still happening at Warminster? Are these things, and I use the word reservedly, after all the Spanish word for thing is cosa, and Spanish sightings, the witnesses there describe them as cosa, are we still seeing them? The short and very honest reply is yes, but not so consistently. In April of 1966, that's going back a bit, isn't it? I wrote to Dennis Healy a letter from a professionally trained observer. I'm a non-entity as a person, but that's my job. And I invited him warmly, together with the cabinet, to come to Warminster and see these incredible things that we were seeing on every clear night. That's 2.5 years ago. I was politely rebuffed by a Mr. M.H. Toft of the ministry, who said that the minister was a very busy man. But he did, after going through the whole incredible gamut of preferred alternatives to UFOs, meteorological disturbance, weather balloons, sun dogs, reflections from bird wings, Venus, the most milked sacred cow of officialdom I've ever heard of, as an animal. After this, he did admit that 90% of all sightings, so far as his investigators know, he worded it in a rather different way. He said that less than 10% are inexplicable. Well, when I told Bob, you know, he's an ex-RAF man, one of my three-person team, when I gave him this information, he waxed wrathful and he said, well, for heaven's sake, Arthur, tell him, from me, that we've got the whole ruddy 10% over Warminster every night. What I am rather pleased about is the temperature or the climate of public opinion towards these craft has changed considerably over the past year or so. This is very welcome. Nobody likes to be considered a fool, especially if he thinks, well, in his particular job, he's a bit of an expert. But there is no such thing, and I would be the first to acknowledge this, there is no such thing as an expert on ufology or UFOs. One can only apply oneself to what one sees oneself, what one hears. The reports of others, bearing in mind that one has to transmute the dross or to throw away the dross and retain the gold in certain eyewitness accounts. As a responsible journalist, I think fairly, I can judge a person pretty well. Now, I'll give you a recent sighting which made no newspaper at all. I sent it off to all the Sunday papers, didn't get anywhere. A bank cashier and her husband, a headmaster's wife, Mrs. Mine, a farmer, Joseph Gray, and his wife, Florence, five good witnesses of a UFO which came very low over the farmland at Glebe Farm Dairy, Coffin, 6 miles from Warminster. Wednesday, August 21, this year. Now, this was reported, sensibly, by the farmer to the local police. And they noted it, they told me, so I went out and interviewed the people. Now, here's still, unfortunately, the official attitude coming into play. I plugged this in a local newspaper, in the Bristol newspaper, and the Bristol Met Office immediately said that this must have been a fireball because it was seen over Bristol heading south to north at about 9:30 p.m. Our sighting happened at 9:35 p.m. It was not the same night, and it was in sight for over 3 minutes, time enough for the farmer to rush indoors and get his binoculars onto it. And he described it to me in good old-fashioned farmer's language as very much, he said it was as big as a bucket to start, to the eye, as big as a bucket. Good old farming expression. Didn't have anything in it, I hope. But the point is, a saddle stone rounded at the top, and if you know anything about saddle stones, you will appreciate this is a good shaped flying saucer, and I hate that term, a celestial chariot. Soundless, which shook the five of them, no sound at all. In sight, in view, for 3 minutes, heading northwest to south. Now, if it had come on in that direction over Bristol and been a fireball, even had it been the same date, it would have come nowhere near Warminster. Now, we had to be very careful, you see, because these official people rush in immediately if there's anything at all suspect. And yet, when given good sighting material, I used to work in close cooperation with the ministry, believing like a fool that they would back me, that they would come down, that they would sponsor us, that they would finance us, help us with better equipment. It never happened, of course it didn't. But they still had our negatives in prints, and they were still sending them back with no comment attached. That's fair enough, fair enough. Pleased us. No comment means, well, it could be true, of course it could. I will only digress if I put this thought to you that a number of pilots obviously must have had far closer viewings of craft than we have. And we've been very privileged. On 7 occasions in the last 18 months at Warminster, we have seen 8 landings. 8 landings in 7 evenings in the last 18 months. Now, how does one determine a landing? I will give you a typical example, and I won't speak off the cuff now, because this is in my new book, and I'm not plugging the book. Here is a report in the Wiltshire Times and News, not my newspaper. It carried the front page headline on Friday, May the 10th of this year, "Blinding light swoops on car. The Warminster thing has reappeared." This is a pity when they say reappeared. Honestly, because on average still we're seeing them at least once a week at Warminster. And I'll come to the reason for that later on. But the newspapers won't touch the yarn normally. But this is by their Warminster reporter, Bob Randall. "The Warminster thing has reappeared. Telecommunications engineer Mr. Trevor Marsh of 10 The Close Warminster used to have an open mind about the thing, but he says after it hovered over his car on the main Warminster to Bath Road near Warminster on Monday night last week, he now has no doubts left. He was driving home between 10:40 and 11 p.m. after visiting his girlfriend when he saw a flashing light over Norwich Wood." You may remember, if you read my last book, how significant Norwich Wood is. "He thought it was a helicopter's navigation light, but the light came towards the car, almost blinding him and creating severe static on his car radio. He slowed down to 10 miles per hour because he was dazzled. As the light came right over the car, it was blotted out by a huge circular object underneath it. Trevor estimates the object was about 3 times as big as his Morris 1000 and about 30 feet above it. But it could have been bigger and higher or smaller and lower." That's relevant, very relevant. It's very sensible. Unless you know beforehand the height of the object or the only other alternative, the dimension of the object, you can't measure speeds, for example. "The object was blue-green at one end and red at the other. He was unable to tell what it was made of and unable to see any metallic shine or rivets. As soon as the light was masked and he could see properly again, Trevor drove into Warminster as fast as he could. It gave me a right old breezer. He is a teenager, only 19, he admitted later. I was shaking all over. When I got into town, I slowed down and looked back, but it had gone. There was no sound. I came along the road about the same time on Tuesday night and I went like hell, I can tell you, but I did not see anything this time." Now, one can't beat that for candour on what to us is quite an ordinary event. This may sound incredible. Before I go into any other sightings, and I'm leaving the most dramatic one to the end, because no one apart from us three at Warminster will ever believe it. I'm leaving that till the end. Let's try and assess, in a practical, scientific sense, why Warminster. All over the world, and I've checked South and North American sightings very carefully, forget about LAYS, L-E-Y-S. I'm sorry about this, but it just doesn't fit anymore. LAYS can be found any old layer. Concentrate more on fields, and particularly concentrations of lines of magnetism. Now, in the magazine Nature last year, this was brought to my notice, and I'm glad it was, because it works into the pattern of this at Warminster. It was there declared that you can measure these magnetic force lines, obviously. It tells you where to get books about this in this book. But the point is that one particular concentration of force field, of electromagnetic power, over this Earth and over Britain throughout the whole of 1966, although it fluctuated considerably, although it altered direction considerably, it may, for example, at one period of the year have stretched from Southampton to Newcastle. At another period it might have come down from Notts to the Isle of Wight. It might have gone across from Guildford to Glastonbury. But wherever that power line shifted during the whole of the year, the only town which was always in the middle of it was Warminster. Now that's a good scientific finding. As you read the book, you will find that I go away eventually. I'm sorry about this. The conclusion of my book will probably shock a lot of you, because you think, well, old Shuttlewood comes and spouts and he gives us some factual accounts. But what on earth has happened to him in this last couple of chapters? I will only say this: for over 2 years, diligently and very meekly, we tried to estimate, to evaluate accurately all that we were learning. And in a scientific sense, we could measure speed of the craft at over 100,000 an hour. We could make fairly reasonable deductions from the shapes of the craft, the three main shapes: long or cigar, round, and bell or flying saucer. The shapes are already on the ground around Warminster in the form of earth, tumuli and burial barrows. This is only a fair assumption. We're trying to get to grips with something which has not the tangibility that we would desire as scientists. In other words, if they come down and they land, they let you come aboard the craft, you can see what's aboard or who's aboard, you can determine with microscopic slides correct analyses. Failing that, as a scientist, and doing scientific appraisals, you fall woefully short of proving the identity of craft, and the people, and the purpose of their visits in vastly more numerical numbers than ever, numerical concentration than ever before in history. But the round barrow is on the plane. The bell barrow, which contains a certain amount of flint, is on the plane, and the long barrow, where the experts are digging into history, a prehistory of 4,000 years ago when assessing Stonehenge, where they tell us that the ancient chieftains lie buried. Now, if one does an aerial survey, and I've checked this very thoroughly, if one does an aerial survey of these barrows, then draw a ground floor map when you come down, it doesn't make sense at all. It doesn't make any sense at all. The juxtapositioning of all the barrows, nothing. But apply a mathematical mind and take away certain types of barrow from other types of barrow, and you find that by subtracting the smaller barrows from the large, the chieftain barrows, or the cigar shape, you see clearly marked on the ground constellations in the northern sky. in much Ursa Major, the Pleiades. Now this probably means nothing. It's a minor revelation perhaps, but when you are trying to appraise something scientifically, which doesn't give you any scientifically appraisable fodder or material, then you're stranded, you're out on a limb, and you must surely use your own humble faculties to determine, to your satisfaction at least, well, here's something that makes a little bit of sense at last. So we've got the speed of the craft, we've got the shape of the craft, and you'll go on and pick up many minor pieces of information about electromagnetism. For example, that it's quite feasible that they do use electromagnetic forces, possibly with the secret additive of knowledge of harnessing certain strength and certain length sunrays. I can't say more than that. The book does, but I'm not here to plug the book. But you see, you're out on a limb. Now, something happened to me last August, and this is on a purely personal note, and I'm sorry to have descended to the personal level in this way. Something happened, and you can believe it or not, when you get to it in the book, it's as true as I stand here waving this pen. I'd be struck, I'm sure, if I was not telling truth. To my knowledge, that's what happened last August, after a particular speech I gave at Caxton Hall. Ivor was there, Eileen was there, I think quite a number of you probably were there, but it was a Contact UK meeting. But the point is, what happened to me when I got back to Warminster, when I was on the point of giving up all this research? I was fed up of our being ridiculed continually. I was fed up of the family life, the even temperament of family life, being terribly upset by this type of investigation. I was fed up by getting bronchial pneumonia on the hill and taking unnecessary health risks and hazards. And I got to a very low stage where I thought, well, finish. Let's finish. Let some other silly fool do a bit of donkey work. I can't get to grips in a scientific way which is absolutely 100% diagnosis and analysis without their cooperation to the full. And they cooperated very poorly apart from many sightings. And sightings no longer mean anything, I'm sure, to anyone. And at that point, something happened to me which made me steer a different course. It made me realize, and you can laugh, I don't mind, I would have laughed at myself a year ago. Behind all this, behind all the many, many facets and aspects, many of which conflict, behind all the incongruities and the ridiculous things that happen in connection with ufology and with UFOs, the craft, and the people, beyond all that, I am confident on evidence that I've got at this moment that great spiritual values, great spiritual undertones, and I don't use the loose word religion, it's a word I don't like, lie behind the whole mystery. Now, up to about last August, I'm blaspheming here, and I'll admit it. I was a hardened ex-policeman, ex-guardsman, kill or be killed during the war. I would have said that the Bible was a good bit of fiction writing. No definite proof there at all, the existence of a God or a supreme creator or a deity in the heavens, what did heaven mean? I found I never used to think about the purpose of life and beyond life, and the end of my book deals with those important things, what I now consider to be important. And I'm sticking my neck out here, of course I am. But until then, a certain three things happened, and there were four witnesses of one particular happening, and one was Lady Marjorie Stewart, who's probably the most powerful woman in Australia. She was one of the four witnesses. Had I been on the hill on that night, Friday, April the 5th of this year, on my own, I would have overblown by the top and thought I was going mad, quite frankly, and you've got to have a strong mind to tackle this subject. I would have either thought, well, I've gone over the top, let's get back home and forget all about it. I certainly couldn't have credited what we were seeing had there not been four of us on the hill all seeing the same two tremendous, what you can only describe as angel figures in the sky. Now, going back again, it's in the book because there were four of us. But going back again, until certain things had happened, I thought Christ was just for the birds. I'm a terrible blasphemer. I was the biggest heathen in creation. Perhaps that's why things have happened to me at Warminster. Things that I didn't expect. Things that I couldn't take certain vibrations. But it's so clear. There are certain warnings, for example, about the taking of certain drugs which are dealt with in the book. Drugs, I've never taken drugs, I like a smoke, quite frankly, but warnings about drug taking in here correspond very much with minor revelations or confidential details which have reached me from all parts of the world from former drug takers. Where a man has a superconscious projection while that drug is in being, and he gains a little mental hold or a toehold on cosmic truth and cosmic consciousness, then it's retracted and it harms him. He doesn't reach that peak again. It's very, very harmful. And certain things in here that if the people from space are true, and I've met one I know of, here again, I'll stick my neck out. Poor old Adamski got his chopped off. I've met one. I've no doubt at all that he was not of this earth. The only thing that worries me, as a reporter, as a fairly reliable link, I hope, a connecting link between what happens on any news front, whether it's futuristic or not, and the public, blow the editors, I couldn't care less about that. The only thing that worries me as a responsible journalist is, and as a responsible human being, is what these people are telling me. Is it all true? Is it going to happen? Now, certain things, there again, I'm not plugging this book. Don't think that. Joe Soap could have written that. But the point is, certain things that have been told me in the past have come bang out on target. And you can only take my word for that. Now, I used to laugh, and I won't mention a name, he's a very senior member of your hierarchy, of your executive committee. I've heard him speaking, I've seen writings of his, and I thought, well, it's impossible. He might laugh at us when we say that these craft literally disappear before your eyes. And you look around, you think your eyes are being deceived. Gunmetal grey, sun strikes it through lurking clouds, beautiful silver jewel, and then it's gone. Look all around. Perhaps a minute later, your team comes back, and this would be a marvellous thing if you could do it. But imagine a spider spinning a web, or a silkworm spinning its silk, the threads, gradually assembling, speed it up a million times. Then you see that UFO, that celestial chariot, absolutely crystallized, firm, clear-cut before your eyes again. Now, you can't, even if you want to be the most hard-headed scientific chap, you can't doubt the evidence of your eyes when you see that happening. So therefore, the point in time, perhaps, the point in technical evolvement, the point in spiritual evolution of some of these people must be tremendous to have overcome that handicap. In other words, they're obviously using a para-Einsteinian time-warping technique, or perhaps, as John would liken it, a hyperdimensional link which apparently short circuits or bypasses space and time. Sounds like space fiction, but when you see it happen, you know it's so true. So you can only conclude, it doesn't matter what the blind experts say, and we have, thankfully, we have enough seeing experts today who are willing to come up and check these things, one can only say that the craft, therefore, are capable of ultra-vibrationary rates of acceleration, or if you like, they revolve their photons, units of light measurement, at such a fantastic degree that they do disappear. And therefore, what or who is on board must, therefore, have the same propensity or capacity. So if one can imagine, if we were able, if we were at that state of vibration and we were using a little more of the 9/10 of untapped mental energy that we're not allowed to use perhaps at this particular time, one can then see and blow all our scientific concepts. I'm sorry to say this, but when you've seen the visible proof, you feel great, great sympathy with our scientists, particularly the open-minded ones. But the scientific concepts are just down the drain so far as Abbott and team are concerned. The people can alter at will or whim, they can raise or lower the frequency, or the atomic frequency, of which all particles are composed. Flesh, animate things, inanimate things, matters not. When you see this happening, it makes your mind boggle, and conservative, blind scientists, and they will have sudden shafts of acute revelation and shock in the next few years, because they can't conceive of anything which has risen above Earth scientific training, traditions and concepts. It's such a pity, such a pity. But there, I'm probably going on now, I should be telling you all about the sightings, and I'm going on possibly to what you might consider hypotheses and theory. But I'll do at least speak truth as I see it. Now, for the most astounding story, if I'm not punishing you too much, because I must admit we punish ourselves on that guilt. The most astounding story, I won't worry to look for. Early January this year, John knows the identity of these two people. Perhaps if you read the book, get it from your library, save you 26 bob. If you read my second book, you will probably guess the identity of these two people. Sane, rational, down to earth. They came up past my home on their way to Cradle Hill. I think it was January the 8th or 9th. It's in the book anyway. But the point was, it was a Monday, and when they reached a little traffic roundabout at the top of our road, before you go on to Elm Hill proper, the UFO came over Cop Heap, which is a hill up there with high trees. You probably, many of you may know it. A UFO came over, very low, darted down in front of the car and away, to the left, towards the downs, approximately east to west. Now the girl on board in the passenger seat was looking to see where the UFO had gone. The car braked to a halt and she thought the man was dead. When the craft came down, although the girl was not affected, the man experienced two sharp stabbing pains in the chest, and he collapsed at the wheel. Could have been a serious accident. Luckily, no. Now, here again, this is where perhaps a certain mysticism creeps into this subject, and it's a pity in a way, and yet we've got to accept, we've got to be tolerant of extrasensory experience. I'm sure of that now. I was obtuse, I was blind before. But to get back to this story. The man's friend at work next day said, B, I'll call him B. B, I had a terrible dream about you last night. He said, I dreamt you died. So So B said, oh, that's interesting. He said, well, what time was it? He said, at about 11:25. Now, this was the time that the UFO came across, and he felt these sharks having fangs. Now, I've broken the sequence a little bit. I was being a little bit unfairly critical of one of your executive members, who I remember clearly writing about fairies, giants, ghosts, poltergeists, and those sorts of things make me laugh, or they used to. But here's an interesting thought on this particular dramatic story, which apart from any other consideration, tells me that that man has probably hit on an immortal truth. People who are tremendously evolved, not just millennia ahead of us, millions of years ahead of us, having already broken many dimensions which are alien and foreign to us at the moment, don't stop at the fourth. Why stop at the fourth? Go on to 10, 14, 40. Providing you're progressing in the right way, well, these people, if it weighs it up exactly in my mind now that they could possibly change, not only shape, not only have a duality of existence which would allow them to live in intense heat radiation, in atmospheric differences from ours, in gravity density differences from ours, I don't quite conceive, but they could also have a capacity, I think, if they can disappear from view, literally, and then reappear, they may be able. And I'll qualify this by the story that I'm going to tell you in a moment when I continue this dramatic story. They may be able to change size. Craft as well. So that when we get throughout history, stories, particularly about Irish leprechauns, about dwarfs and fairies, things which normally I would laugh at as a realist, or giants, could evolve, terrifically evolve people, if it suited their purpose in exploring the depths of our oceans, in exploring, plummeting right down to the central ball of Earth, which is so important for the magnetic equilibrium and currents, and gravity values. Is it possible that they can change from beings very much like us, perhaps they can have a duality of existence, an astral body, a physical body, which is something we must learn about eventually, can they change size down to pygmy status? Can they go up to giant status? That would explain a lot of things, and ghosts and poltergeists, for me now I understand a little bit more perhaps, are simply entities which have their being and can move and can think and act in dimensions which are alien to our concepts at the moment. In other words, they are dimensions which are invisible to us because they are beyond man's spectrum of vision, beyond the ultraviolet, beyond the infrared. Now, to get back to the story, I put that thought into your minds first, deliberately, because you'll probably laugh at the story. I did. The girl and the man drove up to tell me this story, and the man was sat very silent, and he's changed considerably since this experience. You've only got to mention two words to him now, and you'll see his flesh crawl with goose pimples, and he starts to shiver uncontrollably. I won't say what the two words are, but here's his story, as told by the female. Arthur, she said, you can believe it or not, she told me about the stabbing pains. We got there, hadn't we? The next morning, a friend at work telling him he'd had an awfully, awfully vivid dream that this chap had died at 11:25. Now, B said to his friend, well, why say 11:25? I mean, how is it you remember a time of a dream? The man said, well, it was so vivid. He said, I looked up. He said, I thought I couldn't have been dreaming. So I looked at the clock, 11:25. I was tied up. But here's the point. The girl said they didn't go to Cradle Hill. The man came round and he drove her home. He didn't say goodnight. He pushed her out of the car. He went home and he slept, I think, for 2 days solid. This was on the Monday. I think on the Wednesday or the Thursday, it's in the book, a phone call. I used to laugh at my hoax phone calls. Of course they were hoaxes, or were they? We're bringing the warmth of the story up today. This man had a call at his place of work. He's not on the phone at home. And whoever rang said, "You must be at Heaven's Gate on Lord Bath's estate at 9 o'clock Thursday by your earth hour." He and the girl went. 9 o'clock came, nothing. 2 minutes past nine, a UFO came over. It corresponded to what Al and the team have often found to be about 30 to 36 feet across. They saw it hovering, it tilted, it flew off then to the slope towards Longleat House, which is Heaven's Gate proper. They jumped out of the car over the chain link fencing from the car park across the farther side of the road. They tore between this on along this avenue of trees. And when they came to the slope where the UFO had definitely dropped, they saw nothing. For a time. Then they heard a low whistling sound, very much like a steam kettle. And looking around, behind the bush was a little thing no bigger than a soup tureen or plate. Now you've heard witness accounts, and there are some again in this book, of small grain beacons which are sent out by the larger craft. They're assumed to be by the experts, if there are any experts. Or they're thinking lights which are sent. They're electronic brains which record all speech, record all pictures necessary to give a coherent picture of a current situation to the masterminders in the craft, shall we say. Now this was very much as one of those would have been, no bigger than a soup bowl. This was obviously the UFO which had come over. Now this is crazy, you see. When the woman came to this part and the man had said no word, at one period he said, "I wouldn't tell him," he said, "he won't believe it." She continued her story. From the bottom of this craft appeared a golden ladder. Imagine a craft 4 or 5 inches off the ground, no bigger than a soup plate, a little trapdoor underneath opening, and a little gossamer fine golden ladder coming out. But of course I was laughing by this time. Of course I was. I thought, well, I thought we were crazy, but I mean, perhaps it's a pity that more of the world isn't crazy, but there, that's an aside. Now, down this little ladder, a golden ladder, came 30 small figures. Fairies, if you like. Ridiculous, isn't it? Apprehensively, even though it was small, these two went away from the car. The figures on the ground came up to the size of the two watchers. He shook hands with them. He spoke in good English. And although the woman didn't want to leave the man, they insisted that the man could accompany them on a special journey. Remember the double chest wound. This sounds bizarre, fantastic, of course it does. Taken out of context in this book, it's mad. Read it in the context, it may give fresh thought for certain mysteries of the past. I was laughing, of course I was laughing like a train. And the chap kept saying, "I should have told you not to tell her, shouldn't have told her." Well, she was so serious about this story, and she said, "Well, we've got to get it out of our systems, it's stuck in our necks, we must come to you and tell you." The man handed over all his metallic objects that he had, including his car keys. And the girl waited there from just after 9 until 5 in the morning. And this is in the depths of winter, January this year. She was waiting, scared stiff, for him to come back. Very apprehensive that he wouldn't. The point is, when he went away with these people, they diminished in size, and so did he. Now, remember the two shocks. Done for purpose. Had he not been killed, inverted commas, quote, killed, quote, he would not have had the capacity or the potential to join them as little men of that size. Now, I'm still laughing, of course. I'm still laughing. He went up the golden ladder, the little ladder was drawn up, the low whistling sound accelerator, and off they went. When it went above the trees, it was a normal UFO size. 8 hours later, about 5 o'clock in the morning, he came back. The girl was frantic. You can imagine 8 hours in the midst of lonely surroundings. It's bad enough at Cradle Hill, but Heaven's Gate must be even worse. I'm still laughing, you see. He came back, and he told her the most amazing story of where these people had taken him. He expected them to take him to the moon, which is probably one of their little bases, at least to take him to one of the planets in our own solar system. Certainly not beyond. But they didn't. He alleges that they took him to the deepest part of our oceans between mid-Atlantic and mid-Pacific. And down there, on the bottom, he saw the most amazing and beautiful cities and architectural forms that he's ever seen in his life. Beautiful splendor. Huge mountain peaks running along for miles and miles. Mountains that dwarf Everest. Now remember, this man had not said a word except to slightly rebuke the girl for daring to tell me. And the girl, in the end, she quite broke down about it because I was still laughing. She said, when B went down to their size and they got on board the craft, she said, I could have rushed over and picked it up and shaken it. And she said, I could have cried my heart dry because they were taking him from me. Now, he was a nice, feminine, slightly romantic touch person. But no, I was still laughing. When the man said one thing to me, all right, Alf, he said, you've had a good laugh. And he said, what does the ball of our Earth, the central magnetic fluid or core of this planet, mean to you? And he said, that's all I'm allowed to tell you, so at this time. Now this really shook me and I stopped laughing. I stopped laughing and I had to accept that this story, bizarre and ridiculous, fantastic though it may be, had a great semblance of truth in it, that it wasn't just a mere traumatic nightmare. The center of our Earth is apparently why there is so much aerial activity of UFOs at this present decade. They are guided by higher intelligences, but their practical and scientific purpose in our atmosphere, I've been told. This was 9 months before I was told this amazing story, this contact story. In May of last year, I learned that there's something wrong with the heart of our Earth, and that these craft are simply reactivating and reconstructing an aerial grid system which has not been in existence since biblical days, that is now very, very important to take away the pressure from a dying heart of the planet. To effect this, there has to be very skillful, inordinately skillful juggling, dexterous juggling of polarity reversal factors. Now, as soon as this man said to me, laugh away, Arthur, but I've only one thing to tell you from these people. What's wrong with the ball of our earth? When everything made very good sense. The man, I was telling you about the goose flesh. Any one of you could come to Warminster tomorrow, and if that man was in your company, and he wasn't wearing a jacket, and as is normal, his sleeves rolled up, even in the middle of winter. If you said two words to him, you would see a violent reaction. He told me about the ball of the earth. Later, he told me that while at work, and this can occur at any hour of the working day, it never happens at night, he has a terrific mental pull that he just can't. He can't deny it. And he knows he's got to go to heaven's gate. Now, I've given you the two words now. He goes to Heaven's Gate immediately in his car. He's in charge of about 200 men. He's a very responsible man in his job. But whatever he's doing, a government contract or what have you, he leaves immediately and he tears off to Heaven's Gate. It's as though he's got a mental receiver set now that he never had before. And there's a pull on it from these people. Now, he's had this experience several times. He goes straight to Heaven's Gate, and he wanders up, and when he gets near to where this craft had landed and brought him back, he meets a person, but it's not a person of the craft that he knew on there, on short acquaintance. It's no one of this earth that he knows. Very dark, very intense eyes. And there's something which is a little bit fearful about this man. He has a part. And this man tells me, and I do believe him, honestly, because of certain little things that have happened to me now. And I can only speak personally. But the man then just materializes and he dematerializes. Like the machines that we watched doing that on the Chittan to Tilshead Road to the east, near Stonehenge. We have certain reasons to believe that there's a power source deep under Stonehenge. That it links to a power source deep under Heaven's Gate. That both are linked to a power source deep under the pyramids. Don't ask me why we think that. Certain factors. Remember the triangle we kept getting on film, which is described in here, and what we analysed it as meaning in its significance and symbolism. But this man, who keeps appearing and disappearing, you mention Heaven's Gate nowadays to this Mr. B, and you'll see his skin writhe in front of him. Now that would seem to indicate then, if he's speaking truth, and I can't think otherwise, I've delved very deeply, he's a very respectable man, and he's, well, I can't give high enough praise for certain work that he's done. But it would seem to indicate that although the majority of UFOs and their occupants around Warminster skies over the past 4 years are what we would evaluate pretty certainly as constructive and a helpful influence to Earth people. While that is the case, there may be also a hostile element which is out to stop perhaps a mission of mercy from more enlightened people. I wouldn't Well, I'm going back to I, and I shouldn't say I, because the ego is nothing. It should be plural. But some of the stories which emanate from South America, and particularly they seem to have a terrific sensational flavour about them. And I think that the almighty dollar is at work here, I must be honest. I don't think that the hostile element comprises more than 3% of UFOs as a whole. Certainly our experiences, and they're quite manifold now, and I make that claim very meekly, at Warminster, we've had very few real flights, but we've had hundreds of wonderful, heartwarming thrills. And I do think you can laugh at the last few chapters of my book if you want to read it. Just remember this, though, that I speak absolute truth as I know it. There may be quite a lot of redundant material there. There may be stuff there that you couldn't entertain as truth, such as the stone of Scone, for example, is perhaps an inspired guess. But 3/4 of the book contains hard factual stuff, and if it only makes people, even government people, think a little bit more than they've done in the past, I think any book which does that, particularly on this most important subject, is worth writing. It's worth being laughed at and gaining a very false notoriety or fame. It's worth sticking your neck out, and it's worth believing deeply and profoundly in all, I'm sure, that you believe about these things.